Schmidt v. McAuliffe. Mr. LaFon.
May it please the court. While serving a 20-year prison sentence for a 1990 rape conviction, Scott Schmidt underwent voluntarily years of intensive offender therapy. After completing this therapy, the state of Wisconsin concluded that Mr. Schmidt had significantly...
You know, I'll tell you, I don't believe in this therapy stuff. I don't see any evidence in the academic literature or anything you say in your brief to suggest that there's effective psychological treatment for sex offenders.
Your Honor, I think that ultimately that question may, I guess that may go to the probative value, to the reduction of the probative value of this evidence because of intervening events. I think there are other reasons why the probative value is low. But I don't necessarily agree with Your Honor. I think that at the very least, the fact that states all over the country engage in this therapy and indeed justify civil commitment in part based on the therapy that committees receive is itself very, very convincing evidence that this therapy does
work. There's no convincing evidence that there's any efficacy to this talking therapy.
Your Honor, in any event, the state, after determining that through this therapy, Mr. Schmidt had significantly reduced his risk of reoffending, it also concluded...
I don't buy that.
All right. It also concluded...
What's the evidence that it reduces the risk of his reoffending?
Well, the state, Your Honor, said as much, and I think that the state views this therapy and its experts who engage in this therapy as reducing the risk of reoffense. I think that we can put weight in the fact that the state relies on this as...
Well, the state is not conceding that he's cured, right?
No, certainly not, Your Honor, but ultimately, that's not the only question here. Mental illness.
So, what is the question?
Well, the question here, Your Honor, is whether the state's use of statements made by Mr. Schmidt during his therapy.
Well, of course he used them. They're admissions against interest.
Your Honor, nobody
used them. Why wouldn't you use them?
I think the state wouldn't use them because their prejudicial value greatly
outweighs
their
probative. Well, admissions against interest are always prejudicial, obviously.
Your Honor, the question is not whether it was simply prejudicial. The question is whether the prejudicial value greatly outweighed the probative.
Well, of course it's very
value.
Valuable. It portrays him as a monster out of his own mouth.
Well,
so naturally it's extremely damaging.
Yes.
Well, any admission, confession by a criminal is damaging.
Yes, Your Honor.
That doesn't make it inadmissible.
No, not in general, Your Honor.
Well, why here?
Well, here, Your Honor, the question before the jury was the risk that Mr. Schmidt would reoffend. Prejudicial evidence, by its very nature...
Why do you call it prejudicial?
Because...
This is evidence in which he confesses to his misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's... highly probative.
Right, but the misconduct had already been established in this case and was not in dispute. There was no need
yes,
for this evidence.
But the details that he gives in his confession greatly augment our knowledge of this person's disposition and likely future behavior.
Well, Your Honor, I think that his state of mind 20 or more years in the past is not as probative.
But here's the problem you faced. He was on parole, right?
Yes.
He was on parole. He gets a parole violation in 08, so some almost 20 years later. but it's the nature of the probation violation, viewing pornography and being terminated from the required mandatory sex offender treatment, and he was terminated because he didn't disclose to the treatment group inappropriate behavior, viewing pornography and communicating with women on the internet, right?
Right.
So in terms of the jury trying to make a decision about his future conduct, that's why looking at what he had done in the past and his conversations during the therapy become relevant.
Your Honor,
right? You agree?
Yes,
that's
yes,
relevant.
Yes, Your Honor. But importantly, the question of relevance is not here. Prejudice is concededly
right.
relevant evidence.
Right, but you realize that that's relevant. Some of what he said during those discussions are relevant.
Certainly, and I think sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
No. I'm just saying you agree with me on the first step. Then the question is whether or not the prejudice outweighs the probative value.
Correct, Your Honor. And
that has to be weighed in light of what the violation is that they're trying to determine.
Well, yes,
and
Your Honor.
And also the civil, whether, you know, the well, civil commitment issue.
Yes, Your Honor. The elements in the civil commitment are the index offense, which was already established via a stipulation. There are the mental illness, which was not disputed. Every expert agreed that he had a mental illness that predisposed him to sexual misconduct. And it was the third element, the future risk, and the unfair prejudicial effect of this evidence.
But there's no indication that people age out of this behavior.
There is, in fact, Your Honor. There was substantial testimony.
Isn't.
Your Honor, there was substantial testimony at the proceeding, which is in the record, with experts saying that as people age, their risk lowers. There is, in fact, evidence of that.
No, that's not correct, because those statistics of dubious reliability in any event, they define recidivism as re-arrest, not the commission of the sexual crimes. And for all I know, for all I can think of, these therapy sessions help a person to figure out how to reduce the chances of being rearrested for your sexual offenses, right?
Your Honor, there's certainly no evidence that the therapy teaches patients how not to get caught.
Of course it does, because it tells them, you know, don't do this, don't do that, they'll be reported and so on. It warns them,
Your Honor,
not that they tell them how can you offend without being caught. It tells them, you know, if you do this, if you do that, the other thing, you're going to be sent back to prison, right? If you keep having sex with 11-year-olds, you know,
Your Honor, those are not the facts of this case.
Would not interrupt me, please.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Okay. So he'll say, all right, I can say to himself, all right, no more 11-year-olds. I'll start with 12-year-olds, right?
No, Your Honor, there's certainly no evidence that was any part of Mr. Schmidt's therapy, and it's ultimately not relevant to the issues on appeal. The issues on appeal here are whether the graphic evidence that was introduced at Mr. Schmidt's civil commitment proceeding, whether it created an unfair risk that it would lure the jury away from...
Actually, Mr. LaFont, that's the issue on the merits. We've got a number of hurdles to get over before we could get to that question. And I'd like to ask you about some of the procedural issues concerning the claim for habeas relief.
Sure, Your Honor.
First of all, you've objected to the district court raising the issue of procedural default on her own, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your view that the district court is somehow prohibited by law from raising that?
It is. It is prior to service, Your Honor. Prior to service, the rules say that only facially frivolous habeas claims can be dismissed. And almost by definition, an affirmative defense that can be waived cannot be a facial reason.
Have we said that?
To dismiss a claim.
No. The Supreme Court told us that you can't, that a district court can't just say, check the state court records and say this was never presented before?
Your Honor, the habeas rules say that you go by the face of the petition, not outside evidence. This court has said that only patently frivolous habeas petitions can be dismissed prior to service. And the Supreme Court, in a similar context in the PLRA, has said that a court cannot rely on an affirmative defense when screening a prisoner complaint. I think there's...
Okay. Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
Sure.
With respect to, I understand that you contend that this has been fairly presented, and you make a pretty good case of that, under the Ellsworth against Levenhagen case. If I understand the argument, it is in essence that because the petitioner told the state courts, in essence, I was denied a fair trial and I should get a new trial because this disproportionately prejudicial and non-probative evidence was admitted, that judges should be smart enough to see in that a constitutional claim, right? Particularly with the citation to Witte, which does cite the constitutional standards.
And the most importantly, Your Honor, as was most important in Ellsworth, most important here is the invocation of the, quote, right.
Yeah.
In Ellsworth, it was the right to be present. Here is the right to a fair trial.
Right. Now, my question, the question that I think really concerns me is whether on that theory of fair presentment, when the state court rejects the claim, we should also treat that rejection as a rejection of the implied federal claim on the merits entitled to 2254D deference. Because I would think that what's good for the sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander on that.
I think that one would go into looking at a state court opinion if you've established that something is fairly presented, and thinking, well, if it's fairly presented, there's at least an assumption that the state court will get to it. But I think you can look at what the state court did here when it didn't balance at all. It only analyzed.
It analyzed the issue that was presented to it, right?
I would say no. No, it didn't, Your Honor. It didn't even mention prejudice. For example, it simply said that evidence of past conduct is highly probative.
Okay. Well, let me back up to the more general question, though. If we treat the issue as fairly presented, should we treat the rejection of it as a rejection on the merits under Harrington against Richter that is entitled to deference under 2254D?
I don't think that one necessarily leads to the other.
Why not?
Though. Well, because I think that any claim that is fairly presented, a state court could ignore.
Okay, what you're making actually, that sounds to me like a good argument against Ellsworth. That is, if we're going to, because if we're going to hold state courts to guessing about the claims that might be the federal constitutional claims that are silently presented, without being called out specifically, if we're going to treat those as fairly presented, then we should also treat those as having been fairly decided, as having been decided on the merits when the state court decides the issues that are actually presented to it.
Well, Your Honor, I would first start by saying that this claim was not silently presented. It was presented as a...
in essence, embedded in the state court argument.
At worst, Your Honor, it was a nested claim, which this court recognizes as fairly presented.
A what claim?
Sorry?
A what claim?
A nested claim, when it's not in a heading, for example. But
Nested?
Nested claim.
As in Matryoshka dolls.
But, Your Honor, you could see a case where the only issue in big headings was the constitutional claim, and yet the state does not rule on it.
Well, if the state doesn't rule on that, sure. But the problem here is you're trying to rely on this implicitly fairly presented under the Ellsworth standard, which I don't disagree with, but I just don't see how it's fair to the state courts to say, we're going to decide de novo because this claim was not called out specifically enough so that you actually addressed it separately.
Well, Your Honor, I think that would create a new rule of law in kind of examining these cases. I don't think that it's necessary. There's a separate question about fair presentment, which sticks to its factors, and there's a separate question about whether the state analyzed it, and there's law to determine whether the state analyzed the claim. Once you've decided under this court's precedent that the claim has been fairly decided, then you need to look at the state case and just ask yourself.
And we treat it as rejected, right?
Well, I think there's a presumption that you treat it as.
And Harrington tells us that even an unexplained rejection is entitled to deference, right?
Right, right. But here they did more than just unexplainedly reject it. They explained something else, which is not the test that applies here. So either the state didn't address it, or it addressed it applying the wrong rule of law, and it applied it unreasonably.
Let me ask you one other quick question. Was there any objection at trial to this evidence,
No.
The argument?
No, Your Honor, there was not.
But isn't waiver, that a problem?
No, Your Honor. Waiver is not an issue here. It was not a procedural
not
bar.
Not yet.
No, Your Honor. It was not a procedural bar that was relied on by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. So it's not a procedural default in this case. And if I may finish with this, the Wisconsin state courts are quite generous on waiver, particularly when it comes to constitutional claims, as cases that we cite in our brief. When it's a fundamental constitutional right, they will consider it notwithstanding waiver. And the court regularly does that.
Thank you.
Let me hold you for a moment, change the subject.
Sure, Your Honor.
What was the nature of the therapy that he received?
The nature of the therapy that he underwent in prison is not fully set out in the record, Your Honor.
Well, is it partially set out?
I know that he it was there were various forms of group therapy, of talk therapy, of helping him control urges and things of that nature.
And let me just ask you another question, too, because I know there was a stipulation at the trial as to his past conviction.
Yes.
Was there any detail surrounding that stipulation?
It was very detailed, Your Honor. Are you asking the detail? Yes,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Because, you know, your best argument is this repeated reference to the first person.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And so I just wanted to know what was the scope of the stipulation. Was it just, you
sure,
know,
Your
he
Honor.
Was convicted of the rape? Was there detail in
no,
that?
It was detailed. And to the extent that the state needed to add color or window dressing to its case, it had added it in that and in the numerous other times that it brought up Mr. Schmidt's past conduct. This was not a completely dry presentation to the jury. In essence, this evidence added nothing but unfair prejudice. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. LaFon. Mr. Weinstein?
May it please the court. An interest of justice claim in the state of Wisconsin is a statutory claim that gives the Court of Appeals the discretionary power to reverse if the real controversy has not been tried or if justice for any reason has miscarried. While one can state an interest of justice claim where the underlying basis is constitutional, that is not a requirement. And relying on an interest of justice argument in either the circuit court or the court of appeals does not call to mind necessarily a constitutional question. Usually in Wisconsin, the interest of justice claim appears at the end of a brief after other arguments, usually constitutional ones, have been made, and it is, I believe, viewed as a concession that the other claims are weak at best. In this case, Schmidt's appellate counsel did not raise the claim directly, because his attorney had not objected to the evidence at trial. He didn't raise it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I think for two reasons. First, because under Wisconsin law, the Supreme Court has said that this kind of evidence is highly relevant to a determination of future dangerousness in a civil commitment case. And second of all, because of that, he would not be able to prove deficient performance nor prejudice. And the U.S. Supreme Court has made similar statements in Hendricks. So he presented only an interest of justice claim. He now relies on Witte versus the state, but Witte versus the state is not considered in Wisconsin a constitutional case. It's a case on propensity evidence, and it was handed down before the adoption of both the federal rule 403 and the Wisconsin counterpart 90403. And it does use the term unfairly prejudicial because that's the language of the statute that was eventually adopted and it was currently well known. And second of all, because the analysis in Witte is primarily an evidentiary one.
Nevertheless, Witte did present a 14th Amendment claim, correct?
No, I don't think he did.
The court wrote, in addition, Witte argues the use of this evidence was so unfair and prejudicial upon the issue of his guilt or innocence as to deprive him of a fair trial and thus offend the due process clause of the 14th Amendment.
Right, but that's one sentence in a long opinion that relies primarily on evidence.
Well, presumably all parts of the opinion are relevant statements of Wisconsin law, right? I understand everybody in Wisconsin understands when they hear Witte and they think propensity evidence.
Right, that's right.
There's this other part that the petitioner is relying on.
But the question before this court is whether or not citing Witte would call to mind to the Court of Appeals in 2012 or 13, whether or not that was a constitutional claim or whether it was an interest of justice claim. And despite the state's urging the Court of Appeals to address this as ineffective assistance of counsel, and that was because in a real controversy not tried, which is the theory that Schmidt advanced in the Court of Appeals, one doesn't have to prove prejudice. And so the state viewed this as an end run around Strickland and asked the court to rule on this as an ineffective assistance claim, and the court declined, saying we're going to analyze this as Schmidt presented it. So to the extent, I suppose, that this is a nested due process claim, one can look at it like that, but it doesn't really call to mind a federal constitutional claim. I suppose in this case, this court could reverse Judge Crabb on the basis that she went outside of the language of Rule 4, which does limit her on Rule 4 to the petition and its attachments. If the court were to do that, I can confidently say that the director would raise procedural default as one of the defenses. It was defaulted not once but twice because there was no objection at the trial. And secondly, the documents that Schmidt did attach to the petition pretty clearly demonstrated that in the circuit court he had advanced only an interest of justice claim. Schmidt attached his post-conviction motion and several of the briefs in support of it, both his and the state's, and the circuit court's decision, which actually did reject the due process claim on waiver, which is why he argued in the Court of Appeals that that was an error because waiver doesn't come into play on an interest of justice claim.
Does Wisconsin have a counterpart to Rules 413 through 415 of the Federal Rules of Evidence?
Not exactly. It does use a more liberal interpretation of 404 in criminal sexual assaults, especially child sexual assaults, but it hasn't adopted the actual Rule 416 mm-hmm. and 415. Mm-hmm. On the merits, I do think that Judge Hamilton raises an interesting question concerning whether or not this would be entitled to deference in view of the fact that Mr. Schmidt is relying on fair presentment. The big problem, if it is entitled to deference, the big problem Mr. Schmidt has is he's not going to be able to demonstrate there's any clearly established federal law because the Supreme Court's never addressed the relevance, either as an evidentiary matter or a due process matter, for civil commitments. And besides that, it seems to me that the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision concerning the fact that this kind of evidence is highly relevant to future dangerousness provides certainly a reasonable application of what does exist under normal due process.
Counsel, in your brief, you seem to question whether Mr. Schmidt was entitled to counsel in the civil commitment proceeding.
He is entitled to counsel, but I think it
I'm
arises
glad to hear you
from
say
statute,
that.
Not from the Constitution.
You don't think he has a constitutional right?
Not at this point. It's a civil case, so the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply.
You think a person can be deprived of liberty indefinitely without having a right to counsel?
Well, that's an open question, and I suspect the answer will come down that the person is entitled, but at this point, the Supreme Court hasn't said it, and it's really not a matter of great concern in Wisconsin because he has a statutory right, and that carries with it all the same trappings as a federal constitutional ineffective claim and mm-hmm. so on.
Can I ask you to address something that was raised in petitioner's reply brief? Because he suggested that if we find this issue is fairly presented, we should skip the remand, we should take judicial notice of all the relevant state court records and go ahead and rule on the merits without having the district court do that.
I think that's pretty unusual, and I'm...
Well, that's certainly true, but as a practical matter,
well, we don't have
what would be, from the state's perspective, what would be a reason to go back into the district court if there was a procedural misstep earlier in the district court?
Well, we don't have a complete record. We don't have the state's briefs in the Court of Appeals or the petition for review, which... probably won't add a whole lot, but it might. You never know.
Well, the point you made earlier about having argued to the appellate court that this should have been done as an IAC, an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, is certainly an interesting twist. So.
Well, although he forfeited that claim too because he didn't have a post-conviction motion hearing.
But back to the question, counsel. In essence, why should we send it back to the district court if there's a procedural problem rather than decide it ourselves?
Well, since this court supplemented with the trial records from the merits standpoint, I guess there's no reason. But there is a lurking second procedural default, which is the attorney's failure to object to begin with. And maybe it's just me, but it seems to me that's really the posture of the case, is that it should go back to the district court if this court believes that procedural
default... Isn't it always better to deal with the merits?
I'm sorry?
Isn't it always better to deal with the merits than find little procedural wrinkles?
I realize this court has done that in the past.
No.
So,
And can you address why there was a stipulation here that had some detail in terms of his prior offense? Why it had to come out three separate times, that detail, the graphic detail?
As I understand it, the parties and the court agreed that rather than trying to didact a number of these documents before they went to the jury, they would just have the witnesses repeat what was in the documents that was relevant and that the court believed the jury should have, and then not send the documents to the jury and just have them rely on the testimony.
So what was the nature of the stipulation then?
Well, there were two stipulations.
I'm just trying to get a handle on the nature of it, how detailed it was. Counsel said it was pretty detailed. It had facts in it. So then the question is, perhaps you needed one witness that needed to testify to that. But there were three witnesses that testified, as I understand it. And there was one, the final witness, testified solely by adding additional first-person statements. So I'm trying to get a sense of...
There were two separate stipulations. One of the stipulations went to his prior conviction, which is an element of, right, of the commitment. And the other stipulation was this agreement about not sending the documents to the jury. And so rather than go through the didaction, we just have the witnesses testify to those aspects that were relevant. I think the reason more than one witness testified to it is because both of the docs relied on that those statements in arriving both at their diagnosis of a mental disorder and an estimate of future dangerousness. The other witness, I think, was his parole or probation agent, and he was also an authentication witness for the Department of Corrections file that contained the statement. I suppose it would not have been necessary for him to actually say what was in the document to authenticate.
If he was just there to authenticate. But my understanding is he did go through some of those first-person accounts. He went through some of the first-person statements, right?
Certainly the doctor did. I can't recall exactly whether or not the parole agent did or not. And one of the recitations, and I can't remember which witness it was, but one of the recitations was on rebuttal.
This place he's committed to, what is it called, Standage or something?
Sand Ridge.
Sand Ridge?
Yes.
Yes,
it's a secure...
Is there a literature on this? I mean, what are these mental health institutions like? Are they really just prisons, or... what's the difference between...
They purport not to be, but they
I
are...
I know they purport not to be. I'm just curious
Well, it certainly looks like a prison when you drive up to it, yeah. But it has a lot of services that the prison doesn't offer, the Department of Corrections doesn't offer. More intensive sex offender treatment, which is...
Now that I understand. I understand that. I was just wondering about sort of the physical conditions, whether they're in little cells.
Well, it's
you know,
not as restrictive.
As they would be in a prison.
On the outside, of course, it's got the
right,
walls and the
yeah.
barbed wire and all that sort yeah. of thing. It's not as restrictive internally as prisons are. The patients aren't kept under the same kind of scrutiny inside. They have
Do they wear uniforms or street clothes?
I don't know that.
Yeah.
But they do have day rooms and more like
so it's
secure mental health restricted. Facilities than the prisons do. It's
okay,
the only secure... There are two other secure facilities, but those deal with people who are being evaluated for not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. This is the only secure facility for the committed sex offenders. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Weinstein. So, Mr. LaFont, do you have anything further?
If I may begin with the procedural point that Your Honor raised about whether or not to send this back down to the district court for ruling on the merits, I would point the court to page A2, which is the first page of the district court's last opinion in this case, where it says, petitioner has filed a petition in which he argues that the introduction of unfairly prejudicial evidence was a violation of his rights of due process. The court says this argument is not persuasive, and the amended petition will be denied. The district court spoke to the merits of this case. I don't think there's anything to be gained by sending it back down. This court has a regular procedure in these types of cases of supplementing the record with things that it needs and then reaching the merits of the case. If I could then speak to Your Honor's question about what Agent Guest testified to as rebuttal. He was the only rebuttal witness, and the only thing that the state's attorney said to him is that I've handed you Exhibit 21. It's Mr. Schmidt's typewritten statement. I would simply ask that you read the first paragraph on page 914. And then the agent simply reads through the first person statements. I think the best indication of the low probative value of this evidence is the way that it was treated in this proceeding. It was simply read out. There was nothing, there were no questions asked. It was not connected to any of the elements. It simply encouraged the jury to punish Mr. Schmidt for his past misconduct rather than commit him based on his future dangerousness.
Wait, now, what would you like to see? I'm sorry. What would you have liked to see beyond just the reading of the confession?
Well, Your Honor, for example, when the state's expert was testifying, the state's expert testified to Mr. Schmidt's past state of mind. And in doing so, he relied on this evidence. Right. He didn't need to read it first person. He relied on this evidence and synthesized it into explaining why Mr. Schmidt did what he did. And that I think that is the proper non-prejudicial way to bring this evidence in. And there were other ways. They already established his past conduct over and over again. The very acts that he was giving first-person accounts of were already established by the state. They asked the expert. They went through conduct by conduct.
There's a big difference between establishing the facts by evidence and a confession.
Your Honor, I don't think so. There was no dispute that he had done these acts. He had already, you know.
Yes, but of course, there's more than doing the acts. The spirit in which they were done, what he was thinking, all this stuff about how it made him feel strong to do all that. That seems to be the sort of thing one would consider in trying to guess how likely he is to reoffend.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the proper way to look at this is what makes this evidence relevant to the element of risk. The state court said that it was because it established past conduct, but we've already shown that the past conduct was already established. The state, which I think is what you're getting to, is Mr. Schmidt's past state of mind. But again, his past state of mind was already established. And in any event, one of the elements
What's
in the case...
What's the evidence that people's dispositions, sexual attitudes, egotistical attitudes, what makes you think they change over time?
Your Honor, even if they do not change over time, Mr. Schmidt's current state of mind was an element in the case. The mental illness that predisposes him to sexual violence, and in fact, on redirect, the state's expert witness testified about his diagnosis of Mr. Schmidt of psychopathy and how that related to Mr. Schmidt's risk. This evidence was already in the record in less prejudicial forms. The only thing that this evidence added was to lure the jury to commit Schmidt based on its fear and disgust about what he had done. He had already served prison time for that. It is not the proper role of civil commitment. The Supreme Court has said this twice, in order to punish once again what has already been punished. It's only about future risk. And what this evidence did was it took the jury away from that and unacceptably risked them committing him based on punishment as opposed to his future risk. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Mr. LaFon and Mr. Weinstein.